Hey everybody, this is Bradley. Thanks for listening to the show this week. A quick note of housekeeping before we get started with the show. You may have noticed with the release of episode 9 that the podcast feed did not update immediately. We've had some issues with our current host, which is Squarespace 6. They hosted our website and our podcast feed. We've had a couple issues, and so Frazier and I have decided to actually move the website and podcast feed to a new host. You will not have to resubscribe. We will just move everybody over through FeedBurner. But the only thing you may have noticed was for the second time that all your episodes were marked as new. We are really sorry about that. We know that's frustrating to you, as it's very frustrating to us. So you may have had it happen one last time, but you should not ever see that again. We are very confident in our new host. And again, thanks for listening, and we are really sorry about the issues. This is Out of School, at the intersection of technology and education. This is episode 10. Frazier is out of town this week on vacation, so I'm joined by a special guest, Andrew from Aerohive. Andrew, I guess if you want to give us the correct pronunciation of your last name.
Yeah, it can be a little difficult. My name is Andrew Von Nagy, for those in America, and for those throughout the rest of the world, the correct pronunciation would be Andrew Von Nagy.
Ah, Andrew Von Nagy. Because I always knew it the other way.
It's actually Hungarian, so it's a two-part last name. So often trips up people anytime I talk to them.
So you were the 84th CWNE, which is the Certified Wireless Network Engineer certification, and this is the one that encompasses all the other ones, correct?
Correct. It's the expert level certification from CWNP, and so they have certifications ranging from entry level with the CWTS through CWNA for a basic associate level, and then they have professional level certifications for security, protocol analysis, and design, and then that culminates in the expert level certification and endorsement.
Yeah, the CWNE, from my understanding, is not even really an exam. It's all the other ones put together, then plus they've got to basically vet you that you know what you're doing and you have the experience, not that you can just pass an exam, but that you've actually done it in the real world.
Correct. It's more of a what they do is you pass all the professional level certifications, and then you have to get endorsed by a current CWNE, provide a couple of essays on real world experience and deployments that you've done, and have that vetted by the CWNP staff to make sure that, you have so many years in the industry or you've written a book and you are a validated expert with real-world experience.
Very cool, very cool. Well, before we get started with our show, I do want to mention our sponsor just briefly, and we'll talk more about them as the show goes on. But we've got a great sponsor this week. It's EasyGrade. It replaces the cardboard EasyGrader that most teachers have in their classroom with a 99-cent app. Again, we'll discuss that more as the show goes on, but you can search it in the App Store for EasyGrade, or you can go to EasyGradeApp.com, and again, it's 99 cents in the App Store, and we'll talk more about them as the show goes on. So really, Frazier and I have talked over the past few weeks. Of course, I'm an Aerohive customer, and he is a recent Aerohive deployment. What exactly do you do at Aerohive day-to-day?
Well, me specifically, I kind of have an odd role at Aerohive. I'm the senior Wi-Fi architect. That's a kind of a weird title, as people in startups in the Silicon Valley like to, just have kind of random titles. What it really means is, day in and day out, I'm an evangelist for Aerohive solutions and for Wi-Fi and wired networking in general. I go and speak with customers and partners. I do seminars and events, and I really help promote not only the technology from kind of an enablement for businesses, and then I take it one step further with Aerohive solutions and how we can enable those solutions for customers and partners specifically with our product.
Now, before you were at Aerohive, I believe you came from Target, correct?
Right. So I'm a Midwest boy, heart and soul, so I like my meat and potatoes. If you will. I came from a customer side. So I actually started out my career in K-12, and I was an administrator for a school district in Omaha, Nebraska for about 7 years. I transitioned from there up to Minneapolis to work with Target Corporation as their lead wireless architect, and I was there for 5 years. So I've got a lot of background on both wired networking and wireless in both education and the retail industries.
Well, you know, it's really, even it seems like 5 or 6 years ago, that no IT person wanted to do wireless. It was always this thing, it's insecure, we don't need it. And now it's really the predominant way most of us are getting online. You know, the majority of my users are coming off Wi-Fi. So you can no longer, you know, hodgepodge your wireless system. You've got to make it a top flight network. It's got to be reliable and it's got to work.
Absolutely. I mean, Wi-Fi in general has gotten a bad rap because of some of the stumblings early on with security from you know the old wireless wired equivalent privacy or WEP encryption standard that first came out with Wi-Fi. It was horribly broken. It took a couple of years to finally validate that, and then so there's been this taboo around Wi-Fi for a long time early on in its history, and it's been a hard thing to overcome for a lot of organizations, especially security conscious organizations in the banking, government sectors. But since higher security was released around 2005, a lot of organizations are really taking the leap wholeheartedly into Wi-Fi because it does enable so much more mobility and productivity for organizations, and they're realizing so many different capabilities that they can achieve with their business that they weren't able to before.
You know, it's my previous employer is a traditional enterprise. It's a telephone company. It's one of those companies that you would have always thought to be a strict Microsoft organization. It was always Exchange and all the things come along with that. And they just recently have moved to Google Apps. And then they're also looking at moving more of their users to wireless so they can quit buying so many switches. They have really, really high-end switches, and they're realizing we can get rid of some of these if we move some of our users to wireless. They're already connecting their iPads to our hodgepodge system. Let's do this right. And it's just kind of blows your mind, really, since, I guess, in some ways, the iPhone and the iPad have launched, that everything's mobile now. And it seems like it started with the CEO and kind of worked its way down. And now you've got IT administrators that were LAN experts are now having to become wireless experts.
Absolutely. I think it's underscoring a larger trend in information technology in general, where it used to be when IT was adopted early by organizations, they built their own applications. They'd had a lot of in-house custom requirements. And so coming from the retail side of the house, I can tell you there's tons of legacy systems and organizations that were built from the ground up because there weren't these large-scale cloud or public companies that could offer these types of solutions. I think what we're seeing now is businesses focus more on the core functionality of their business and trying to, in a sense, not outsource, but bring in experts that can deliver IT at the scale so that they need and the mission criticality that they need, who are the experts, so that they don't have to focus on that internally. So I think what we're seeing a lot of is that's the popularity of cloud services. That's the popularity of mobility in general, is that it enables new processes and workflows where the organization doesn't have to worry about necessarily cabling to every desktop anymore. They can worry about enabling users to do the work that they, in the fashion that they want to do it, and that's intuitive and natural to them. And I think that's a huge component of Wi-Fi in general, because it started out as a consumer technology in the home and kind of migrated into the enterprise after that.
Well, and users have really just begun to expect it. And I don't even know if this is good or bad. Like I've got a friend that he works at a power company, and they allow them to connect their personal iPhone to the corporate network. Obviously, they've got great security on there to keep them to where they need to be. But it's almost like users say, like, look, we get terrible cell phone service in the building. Let us at least have decent wireless so we can get our iMessages from an iPhone because they're running over a data network, or we can get our email. It's becoming just more of an expectation, just as how you go to a hotel and you just expect there will be internet. Usually not good internet, but you expect internet.
Yeah, I think it's really just the difference between technology becoming more ingrained in our culture, right? People are more familiar with technology in their personal lives, and they expect the same level of capability in their workplace. And so I think that's underscoring a lot of what's happening with these trends is people just are familiar with it, and this technology has become so easy to use that you don't have to be a technical expert to use it anymore. And so businesses are kind of realizing that, you know, it's going to be more cost effective in some respects, and probably more beneficial and result in, you know, better employee morale and better productivity if they adopt mobility as a strategic initiative.
Well, one of the things I've heard you talk about on Twitter quite a bit is it's about application control as much as anything. And so that's where, you know, if it, like we have teachers that have their personal iPhones, but they can access our student information system through an application put out by our vendor. And so, you know, we're fine with letting them bring their phones into the network, hooking them up to our Wi-Fi, because we know if somehow they lose their phone, none of our data is at risk. All we have to do is change their password.
Right. I think a lot of the discussion in media and online and in social media around this BYOD, bring your own device, or just enablement of personal devices in the enterprise in general, has focused a lot on security. And security, I agree that security is a big hurdle to overcome with the adoption of personal devices or mobile devices. But I think the focus initially for organizations before they get down the security path is to identify how mobile devices or personal devices in general can better enable them as an organization to achieve what their goal is. And so I think that starts with, you know, defining use cases, defining the applications and the data that need access. And a lot of times that'll require either sourcing or developing in-house new applications that actually enable the workflows that the organization needs to really enable their users. And so I think it starts there. It starts with identifying those use cases before you start just throwing devices on the network and getting them access to data.
So let's take a step back, and let's say that I am a school that is looking to go one-to-one with iPads or go one-to-one with MacBook Airs, and we need a new wireless system. What we have is old. It's wireless G. It's autonomous. What are we looking? How do we go about planning that? Do we try to do that ourselves? Do we find a vendor to do everything for us? What would you recommend for maybe a school with, you know, 300 students?
Well, I think it depends heavily on the skills and expertise of the IT department that the school has hired. I used to work for a K-12 that had 90 schools split between elementary, middle, and high school levels, as well as some administration buildings. And even for a school district that large with thousands of students, you know, we had three or four engineers that even knew what networking really was. So we were able to take some of that stuff in-house. For smaller school districts, I think it really becomes finding the right partner. I was there as an admin in a school district, and I know even in the larger school districts, if you're an admin, you probably are wearing multiple hats. You're doing desktop administration. You're doing directory services. If you may have some sort of small data center you're managing. You're doing the wired and wireless networking. You're doing the firewalling. You might be, you know, involved with database activities. You've got all sorts of different IT projects on your plate, and so wireless is just one of them. And although I'm biased working for a networking vendor, I think wireless is pretty important to you as an admin. You may have other priorities. So I think if you're a smaller school district, finding the right partner and vetting their expertise to correctly design and install the Wi-Fi network based on your unique requirements is the key.
What are, if you're going into a school district and you, how do you start looking at designing a system? And do you do one access point per room, or does it vary from I guess school to school? What are you looking for when you walk into a school?
First, I'm asking questions of not only the IT administrators, but I typically, if I were to go in there as a consultant, which I don't do in my day-to-day work now, but if I had in the past, typically what I've asked is, let me speak to the IT admins, get their perspective. Let me speak to the IT director. Let me speak to a couple of teachers who are probably, you know, on the front lines working with technology in the classroom. Let me talk to the librarian. Let me talk to a couple, you know, different segments of the user base and figure out, okay, what are you trying to accomplish from an education perspective? Leaving technology potentially to the side right now and say, and what are your hurdles to accomplishing that now? And you know, I talk to a lot of teachers, and lots of times they say, well, I'd love to have lesson plans built more around technology, but getting it to work correctly in the classroom is frankly unreliable right now, and I can't base my lesson plan around that unless I know it's going to work 100%. And so there's typically a gap there that I'll find between what they're trying to accomplish and where they're at today. And so I really boil everything back down to the use cases. Yeah. Once I've defined, you know, kind of what they're trying to accomplish, then it becomes a matter of now taking those use cases and translating them into technology solutions that actually work for them. And so what I think ultimately you start off from a Wi-Fi network design perspective is what devices are they targeting for use, not only today but maybe in the future, because technology life cycles are shortening quite dramatically. I mean, it used to be you buy a desktop and it lasts you for 5 to 7 years. Now you're buying laptops and tablets that maybe you refresh every 2 to 3 years. So those life cycles are condensing. So I've got to do a better job of planning out to the future of maybe you're supporting MacBook Airs today, but maybe in 2 years you might look to be supporting tablets or maybe even some other form factor of mobile device that, you know, is just emerging on the market today. So I want to know what devices they're targeting. And then after that, I want to know what applications and what use cases from a content perspective you're looking at pushing. Are you doing ebooks? Are you doing video streaming in the classroom? Are you doing internet and web access, email? Are you doing collaboration between students or amongst groups of students? And so understanding those applications and the devices then really tie into how the meat of how you design a Wi-Fi network.
What do you see are, I guess, a lot of mistakes that you see a lot of schools make in terms of where are the common pitfalls? When they're, let's say they've got a IT staff of 3 or 4 guys and they think they know what they're doing and they go and put it in themselves, what mistakes do they generally make?
I think the biggest thing that we see today is, and it's a problem not only in the education sector, but in, frankly, a lot of other vertical industries as well, as the old mindset of designing Wi-Fi around signal coverage. That is a requirement, but we've moved beyond that because we're seeing such a large influx of devices in the environment that we have to design not only for coverage in all locations, we have to design around capacity. And so what I mean by that is, let's say you take an example of you deployed Wi-Fi 5 years ago and it's becoming outdated and you want to upgrade it. 5 years ago, you probably designed your network around coverage in some common areas, probably not pervasive throughout the environment. And probably you had very few devices that actually use the network. You might have a couple, let's say you had a couple of workstations in the back of a classroom. You had maybe a computer lab that was high density, but it was probably wired into a switch. And so your needs have evolved over time now where you're putting in one-to-one deployments. Maybe you've got 30 or 40 students in a classroom that are all on a MacBook Air or on a tablet, and they all need wireless connectivity concurrently. And so supporting 1 or 2 devices per classroom is a lot different equation than supporting 30 to 40 devices in a single classroom and pervasively throughout the environment. So designing for capacity is probably the number one thing that I would recommend for school districts when they're looking at replacing their Wi-Fi network. How many devices are you going to have? What's their distribution throughout the facility? And then once you know the application they're going to be using, you know, what's the performance level you've got to meet for every client to be successful?
Well, I think that's so true. And really talking about the end solution is not just important for wireless, but it's important for everything technical we do. You know, one of the things I think we often struggle with in education is doing something because it's cool or because it looks cool. Well, do I really want to spend 5 hours on a project because it would look cool on our website? Or do I want to spend 10 hours on a project that actually impact learning? Because ultimately, if the students don't learn, then what we're doing doesn't matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think lots of times the end result that you're trying to achieve is often lost in the shuffle when it comes to IT. It's nothing against, you know, the IT staff or the IT organization. It's just, you know, sometimes there's this fundamental disconnect of people in IT want to worry about IT because they like technology. They don't really, you know, are in some ways separated from the users that they're trying to serve. And I think having better collaboration within an organization of any type between the end users and the IT department, so that you can get that feedback directly and understand what they're trying to achieve, only results in better solutions.
Well, that's so true. And I kind of had to drink my own coffee, I guess would be a good term, this morning. One of our fifth grade teachers is working on a project using QR codes, and she was actually creating the QR codes. She was pasting them around the school, and the students would scan them for a project. And we did not have AirPrint-enabled printing in our building. And so she was having to email the QR codes to herself and then go back to her computer and print them. And I had bought a hardware device earlier this year from a company called Lantronics. It's their X-Print server, and I'll put a link into the show notes. And it's a hardware device that was supposed to make all of your traditional multifunction printers that are network-based AirPrint compatible. Well, I never could get it to work. And I think it works well if you have printers that are supported, but we have fairly new printers, and for whatever reason, they've just never got supported. And so when she was saying, hey, I'd love to print from my iPhone, I realized I needed to get off my butt and figure out a solution. And so I went and bought a $20 solution from a company, it's Ecamm, and they sell an app called Printopia, which basically just runs on any Mac. And so I just installed it on a Mac that stays on all the time. And then you basically, it takes all the printers on the network and shares them out via AirPrint. And I showed it to her today, it worked perfectly, and she was so happy. And that was one of those situations where once I understood how much time I could save her, I just needed to get off my butt and do something about it. Even if it was a kind of a hokey solution, it worked for her, and it saves her time. And the more time she can save, printing out QR codes, the more time she can do plenty of other lessons.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the ease of use, especially of, that the Bonjour protocol that Apple has adopted heavily, and that we're seeing kind of sparse support for by other vendors right now, I think it's set to really take off, because it does enable that kind of ease of use and intuitive nature to it, that you don't have to teach your users around what's a DNS name, what's an IP address. It's like, well, what are you trying to do? I'm trying to print. And Bonjour is one of those simple protocols that you really just bring it up. It said, what are you trying to do on the network? I'm trying to print. Guess what? Here's a list of printers on the network that you can go ahead and use. And it's very, very easy and intuitive. And I think, once we as IT administrators kind of get our heads wrapped around the user's perspective, everything just becomes clearer, and you can just understand what they're trying to do and really deliver a solution that makes sense for them.
Well, yeah, because see, in my head, I'm thinking, do I really want all of our iOS-based printing coming through one computer in the entire building? Well, in an ideal world, that wouldn't be that way. And hopefully one day all of our printers will support AirPrint out of the box. But until then, let's find a solution that we can make work, because it's better to have a slower solution than no solution at all.
Yeah, and I think we as IT personnel tend to over-engineer in a lot of cases as well. It's really understanding the meat from the fat. It's what are we trying to accomplish? What's an easy way to do it? And yeah, it may not be highly redundant, and it may all be going through one workstation. But at the end of the day, how often is that workstation going to go down? And can you live with having to figure out or troubleshoot it once in a blue moon when something does happen, versus over engineering a solution that just isn't capable or isn't available on the market today? And then and then that leads down other rabbit holes of proper documentation and complexity in the network and trying to troubleshoot a problem. If you've over-engineered it, well, would you rather have one place to go look for a problem or 20 where, any link in the chain could have caused something to go wrong? And so I think we need to keep that on the top of our mind as engineers as well. Obviously, architecting around, edge network access for printing and things like that is obviously different than a data center, where you probably want to have completely high availability and redundancy and things like that. So understanding your use case and engineering appropriately, I think, is another big key.
Let's go ahead and take a quick break for our sponsor. Is that okay, Andrew?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. We have a great sponsor this week. Paul Brown is the developer of this application, and actually only lives about 2 hours from me down here in the South. And he has an application called EasyGrade, and it's a new iPhone app for teachers that replaces their cardboard easy grader. Did any of your teachers have this when you were like in elementary school? It's a little thing you pull out that says we had 10 questions and they missed this many and this is their grade. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I did it all on pencil and paper with the bubble sheets. So.
So what this is like when teachers go to grade your, an essay test or a multiple choice test, this basically allows them an easy way to figure out their grade. And this is the best one on the App Store. It's super simple to configure. You can grade a partial credit, and then it allows you to calculate the grades based on a half or whole points. Some of the other great features, you can adjust the number of questions with a quick tap. You can choose whether you want to calculate the grades based on the number of answers correct or incorrect. And then you can easily increase or decrease the font size. And this is big for a lot of our teachers, because when I see a lot of our teachers' iPhones, they have gone in and turned on the universal access to crank up the font. And so when applications allow you to adjust the font, this really, really helps folks that maybe their eyesight isn't as good as they'd like. And this is a big key. It's already been updated for the iPhone 5 and iOS 6. There's nothing more frustrating to me in education to see applications that are not maintained. And Paul's already got this updated for the iPhone 5. I sent this out to our teachers when Paul emailed me because it was a great application. And one of them came by and I showed it to her and she bought it right there on the spot. She said, I've had that same cardboard easy grader for 20 years. I'm ready to chunk it. This really goes back to there's an app for that mentality. So again, it's only 99 cents on the App Store. You can go to easygradeapp.com to find the link and read more about it. Just a fantastic application, and again, for a buck. If you're an IT administrator, you know, do a volume purchase program for this app for your staff as a Christmas bonus or as a thank you. You know, again, you just can't beat it at the price for 99 cents. So again, thanks to EasyGrade for sponsoring the show this week, and it's easygradeapp.com. Now, Andrew, let's say I'm a school that's looking at Wi-Fi today. Do I need to be thinking about wireless AC in my deployment? Because we've heard that, I guess, buzzword thrown around a lot recently by some of the other vendors. Where are we at with wireless AC?
Yeah, well, there's a whole lot of hype around 802.11ac, which is the next generation or next release of Wi-Fi. And it's targeted to be released in the enterprise space or enterprise-grade solutions around the first half to middle of 2013. So next year, in the next, 9 months or so, we're going to see a lot of vendors start to deploy or release these products. They're available today for the home use, and I'm sure you can relate as an administrator. You'll have somebody that's not necessarily knowledgeable about IT come up to you and say, well, I can go to, name your big box retailer, and I can buy this off-the-shelf access point for $100 to $200. Why am I spending, $300 to $500 on an enterprise grade access point that you say I need? And have you ever run into that type of question?
Oh, yeah, because you get the people that say, like, what's different about an Arrowhive access point versus my Netgear router at home or my Apple Airport Extreme? Like, what's the difference? And those are the kind of questions that kind of boggle your mind because it's hard to explain to a non-technical person the differences between consumer grade gear and enterprise grade gear.
Yeah, and the main point that I usually try to make in those situations is, well, your consumer grade access point is meant to be a standalone device. You're meant to put it in a home. It's meant to work just by itself and provide coverage in a home. It's a very simple use case. So it lacks a lot of the intelligence that is required when you have a multiple AP deployment. So let's say you're a school, you've got, 10, 20, maybe even 50 access points in a large school. Those access points, in order to handle the capacity that you're driving in with all these devices, need to have some intelligence and coordinate with one another to hand off clients when they move around in the environment. Because what good is wireless, right, if you have a desktop sitting in the back of the room and it never moves, right? You might as well just run a hardwired cable to it. So the primary use case is for people to move. And so these intelligence features, help clients move around the environment, stay connected, optimize performance in these high capacity areas. So, there's a lot of different capabilities underneath the hood that enable these access points to optimize that client's connection and get the most performance out of it that they can.
Yeah, a perfect example is to me is band steering. That's a feature that is going to be so key in any deployment where, you know, a Netgear router, if you load up 30 clients on there, does it know how to evenly distribute those among the 2.4 band and the 5 band?
Absolutely not. Typically, those devices just allow clients to connect wherever the client wants to connect, and there's no real-time monitoring of the client's connection and optimizing. So, for instance, with Aerohive access points, we support all sorts of different performance features. Some of those are geared toward optimizing the client's connection, like band steering, moving them between 2.4 and 5 gigahertz, load balancing in between access points based on a real-time calculation of, hey, maybe this AP is heavily utilized, whereas the one right next to it is less utilized by a certain amount. And by moving clients around, we can optimize the performance for all the clients on the network. Another big differentiator is quality of service to prioritize applications that are beneficial in your environment. So maybe you're doing video streaming or collaboration or something like that. You need to make sure that that application always works and takes priority maybe over web surfing. And so those are a lot of the types of things that you can do in enterprise grade equipment.
The one that always blows my mind that it works is roaming. Our iPad carts, there are 18 in each of them, and I can roll them from my office where they're connected to an access point that's actually in my office, because that's one of the perks of being the IT guy is you put an access point in your office. And I can wheel them across the room, pick one out, and they're already connected to Wi-Fi. They've just, you know, roamed to each access point as they go. And that blows my mind that it actually works.
Well, that's why why I'm in the industry is, you know, to try to make sure that stuff works seamlessly and perfect as much of the time as possible, right? So fast secure roaming is definitely an enterprise-grade feature that allows those devices to roam between access points in a very fast, efficient, and secure manner. Kind of like, you know, when you're on a cellular telephone call and you are driving down the interstate and you pass between cell towers, you don't want any blip in that conversation, or you don't want the call to drop. One of the most frustrating things for me is when I'm driving around and I've got unnamed orange carrier and I drive through a dead spot and all of a sudden my call drops. That's what we're trying to design our Wi-Fi networks around as well, so that there's, number one, no dead zone, and number two, that handoff between access points happens perfectly every time.
Well, and this is really big with smartphones and tablets, because typically with laptops, you're going to, you know, be in your office, shut the lid, walk across the building, open it back up, and it's going to reconnect. And with a smartphone, we all see the people at our offices that are on their phone the entire time they're walking. And so they want to stay with the full signal the entire time. And it's, you know, how do we make sure that happens? And so, yeah, that's a roaming is so key.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been a big advocate that I'd make the differentiation when I talk with people around portability versus true mobility. Because portability is kind of like your laptop scenario, where maybe you close the lid on your MacBook, pick it up and walk to another room and you reopen it up. You're not really roaming when that laptop is closed. Sure, you're moving it, which is great. It enables so many things for you to do as a user, but the wireless infrastructure designed to support that use case is fundamentally different than somebody on, let's say, a smartphone. They're talking on a voice over IP call as they walk throughout a building, which, by the way, is becoming more and more popular with soft phone clients on smartphones these days with corporate PBXs.
Talk about the technology that Aerohive has briefly for that. When you, like, let's say you roam to an access point that's on another subnet, don't you guys have a technology that kind of gets that, you know, seamlessly back to the original access point?
Yeah, we have two variants. One is called layer 2 roaming, and one is called layer 3 roaming, kind of getting back to the TCP/IP model for network protocols. Layer 2 means the access points are in the same subnet, and they talk with one another across the network all the time, exchanging information about client sessions. And so when that client device decides that it wants to roam to the next access point, all of that client's information is already at the access point ready to go. So he doesn't have to re-authenticate. We have a full stateful firewall for security and BYOD that we have in our access point. So all of the information about what application sessions he has going on that are already opened up, we can continue to allow without having to have the user close the application, reopen them again to reestablish the connection. And it's kind of all pre-delivered to the access points ahead of the client so that once the client gets there, everything's ready to go. Layer 3 roaming is when the access points are on different subnets. And this is typically in larger facilities or environments where they design their wired network backbone to reduce broadcast domains, to prevent broadcast storms, and to improve the performance across a wired network. The access points typically then discover each other over the air, and then they communicate, again, through the wired network across the Layer 3 network boundary. And then, the same as in Layer 2 roaming, they share that information ahead of the client, so that even if the client roams between those boundaries, which to a user, they don't even know where the boundary is, it's a logical boundary in the network, those access points are sharing that information, and it's all ready to go. The only difference then is once the access point, or once the client gets to the new access point, we don't want the client to change IP addresses. Because if the client has a change in IP address on the network, that means all of the client's application sessions immediately just got cut off and dropped. So if you're running a real-time application, maybe you're doing a VDI session or a Citrix session or a voice over IP call, anything that's real-time, if that application drops, you'd have to reconnect and reestablish that session, and that's very disruptive to the user. So what we can do is we can actually dynamically forward the traffic back to any access point in the original subnet. That way the traffic can be forwarded logically across the network so that the client can maintain the same IP address and maintain those application sessions seamlessly.
I think ultimately this is about eliminating a phone call back to IT. Hey, I'm dropping calls. Hey, I'm losing connection when I move offices. Because users really just at this point demand to stay connected. If they're in the building, they want to be connected.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not only reducing a phone call. We've gotten to that point with most client devices today. But take it back a couple of years, and it was actually worse than that. It was the client would, see the same SSID out of the wireless network and try to roam. But when they got to the new access point, they wouldn't realize that they had to grab a new IP address. So a lot of times, many clients were just kind of dead in the water, and you actually had to reboot the device in order for it to come back up and grab a new IP address. For instance, it's still very common, I believe, with SpectraLink phones.
Well, I know there's an actual profile in my Hive manager for SpectraLink, a radio profile, so I know there's something funny with them.
Yeah, and that's why we say, you need to understand the client devices that are in your environment, because they all behave differently. And so the fundamental wireless design is not only for the holistic network and capacity, but it's also understanding that connection between each individual client and the access point, because it's a two-road street, right? It takes two to make the network happy for that connection. We can't solve everything on the infrastructure. We need to understand the client side as well, because we've got all sorts of different clients that support different throughput, different capabilities, and understanding those situations helps us design for those scenarios much better. Did you want to get back to 11AC, by the way?
We kind of got off on a tangent there. Yeah, let's move back to AC.
So it's coming out, middle of next year around sometime. And from a purchasing perspective, what I'd say is 802.11ac, at least the first generation that comes out next year, is not going to be a tremendous leap forward in wireless networking. It's an incremental improvement. And whereas, for instance, the transition between legacy 802.11 ABG equipment and 802.11n, which is what the current standard is, that was a tremendous leap forward because it enabled, for instance, bandwidth to increase from 54 megabits up to 450 that we have on the market today. 802.11ac is going to be more of an incremental improvement, especially in enterprise environments, because a lot of the capabilities that are going to be released with that product are really meant for home use. So you can configure huge channels of 80 megahertz wide or 160 megahertz wide. And those are great for home environments where you have one access point. But in an enterprise where you have, multiple access points, they need to coordinate with one another, so not sharing the same channel, because that ends up sharing capacity. So what we actually want to do is we want to keep them on separate channels. Well, once you start to get into those really large and really high bandwidth channels, you have less to use and less to go around. And so you end up sharing capacity. And so what we're going to end up having is enterprises are going to be able to take advantage of only a few of the advancements in 802.11ac. And so it's going to be really more of an incremental improvement. So I'd say if you're looking to purchase a Wi-Fi system today, 11N is going to be fine. Now, if you're replacing 11ABG, go ahead and buy 11N today. Obviously, once 11AC comes out, I would buy 11AC gear for new access point deployments, but I wouldn't see any need to go back and retrofit 802.11n deployments unless you have some other driver besides just an incremental upgrade for the Wi-Fi.
And I think that goes back to really the overarching topic for the show is find out what your needs are. Don't just think, we've got to have AC because it's faster. Well, do you need AC today? Do you need those speeds today? What are you doing with AC that you can't do with N? Because N is great. I mean, if you compare N to G, it's light years ahead.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, a lot of the improvements just come in signal quality and reliability, not necessarily bandwidth. And that's some of the, you know, the underlying improvements that really make Wi-Fi more stable and more reliable rather than just peak performance. Because I think there's a lot of press and hype around, you know, well, gigabit Wi-Fi with 11AC is coming. But in the end, if you have, you know, 450 megabits raw data rate today, and you might be incrementally getting up to, you know, 600 some, 700 megabits with 11AC, even if you were to deploy it, what's that translate into an end user? Well, an end user may be using an application that actually uses maybe, what, 1 megabit, 2 megabits of actual throughput for, like, real-time applications, or maybe in file sharing where they might burst up to, you know, higher speeds. It really, 11N suits most users' needs, and they won't even notice the upgrade.
What do you see as the trend past AC? I know it's hard to predict the future, but do you have any kind of idea how long we'll be with AC and maybe what will be coming next?
Well, there's going to be a couple of waves of 11AC. The first wave in 2013 will be some of this incremental improvement in peak performance through a couple of different technology methods that, you know, frankly, it's really deep dive to get into how those are made possible. The second wave of 11AC should come tentatively, you know, a couple of years after that, probably late 2014 or 2015 timeframe. And the big advancement with the second wave of 11AC is going to be what we call multi-user MIMO. So 11N introduced MIMO, which is multiple input, multiple output. And essentially, that's sending multiple data streams over the air at the exact same time to a single client. That's part of the reason that we can enable such higher bandwidth with 11N. Multi-user MIMO now means, well, we take sending multiple streams at the same time, but instead of sending it from an AP to one client, we're going to send it from an AP to multiple different clients at the same time. So independent data streams, if you will. One client can be downloading a video. The other client can be downloading a file off of a file server. We can send them out of the access point at the same time on the same frequency and not have them interfere with one another, and both clients be able to effectively get receive their data at the same time. That's going to be a tremendous advancement that's going to come with the second wave of AC. And so that'll be a big improvement that we should look out for.
You know, I guess, to wrap up the show, what do you think about mobile device management? Is that a trend that we talk about BYOD in the enterprise, and we've talked about that some in education. Give me your thoughts on MDM solutions.
I think that gets back to your use case again. So supporting mobile devices in an organization really comes down to two fundamental, you know, differences in use case. One is kind of, so in education, does the school own the device, or are we allowing students to bring in their own device? And fundamentally, that ownership is driving a lot of the security type of solutions that organizations are deploying. So if the school owns it, we're seeing much more broader adopted of MDM solutions in general, because the school is actually owning the device. They need to image it, update software, manage it from an inventory perspective, patch it, you know, the typical runtime activities that an organization needs to do to maintain those devices. So an MDM solution where they actually put an agent on the device, control and lock down the device to a much more granular level, is much more viable. In the other case, where it's more of a bring your own device, or the students kind of owning their own devices and bringing them in, or even from an organizational perspective outside of education, we're seeing a lot more reluctance around MDM solutions for full management of the device. Typically, there's private data and personal data on those devices, like pictures, There's even healthcare and medical applications now where people are downloading them and managing their own medical and doctor's visits and things like that. And so there's a hesitance to give control or visibility into that to either the school or an organization. And so for that aspect, we're seeing a lot more of just scenarios where good onboarding and pushing maybe or delivering a profile for Wi-Fi network configuration so they can get them provisioned and on the network, and then taking the security more into the network side for firewalling, limiting application access, maybe potentially providing remote access in through VPNs or thin applications, and back then to around what's your application ecosystem and what data are you giving them access to.
Yeah, I mentioned this earlier. I think application-driven environments are the key going forward. I really see a day when we may tell teachers, look, here's your stipend for your technology. We'd like you to have one of these three devices because these work with our student information system and our finance system. We'll give you a stipend, and then we'll let you on the network. You can keep it at home and you can access everything. Bring it in. We'll let you on the network. We have everything at the application level. It's more of a, a good balance between kind of work and play rather than just true old school workstation. You come in, you log in, and you can access your data there. And then when you leave, you cannot have access to it anymore.
Right. I think fundamentally, we need to remember that these lots of times mobile devices are personal devices. And so then it's a big difference between issuing a device to a user and actually having them bring their own in. And I think the key, like you said, is in applications and embedding the data security in the application, because managing the devices, frankly, is going to be a losing battle. There's so many different devices and different variants on devices that are going to be flooding into networks that trying to figure out ecosystems and solutions to manage those entire platforms of different platforms is going to be just it's going to be an exponential problem that just, we're going to have to keep addressing iteratively as new devices come out, and it's going to be a losing battle. Whereas if we can say we're kind of device agnostic and say bring in, whatever device you want to use, and we have maybe an application that works across devices, maybe it's, built on a specific technology like HTML5 with a wrapper for each different platform or something that's very easy to develop and put out on those different platforms, is really going to enable the IT organization to support those devices much more easily and with the data security that they need. With that, we see onboarding as one of the main challenges that organizations and school districts are facing. A student brings in a device, how do we get it on the network? We don't have the IT resources to go around and configure every one of those devices for students or for teachers. And so embedding that device onboarding into the network is really key. And so at Aerohive, we've partnered with a company, I don't know if you're familiar with them, called Jamf.
Mm-hmm.
And Jamf makes the Casper suite, which is it's an extension of Apple's ecosystem for management of both Mac OS X as well as iOS devices. And we've bundled that in with native integration into our access points so that you can pop up maybe a captive web portal when they connect to the network and say you need to get enrolled. Download the school's profile so that it has the correct Wi-Fi settings, so that you're secure, up and running. Maybe deliver the applications that the school is providing for your use while you're in the school, and you're ready to go, right? And so that's all automated kind of and self-provisioning with mobile devices with that native integration. And by the way, that Jamf solution, the Casper suite is actually, the licensing is free for educational school districts, both K-12 or higher ed. So if you're really interested in managing your Apple environment, I would definitely go check out Jamf software.
We've mentioned before, Apple has these roadshows that they go around and they talk to schools about one-to-one deployments, and specifically with the iPad generally. And you generally in those sessions, you've got an Apple rep, an Apple systems engineer, and Aerohive folks, and then Jamf folks. And so it's like Apple has said, we can't do everything, and we're going to find partners who do things extremely well, and we're going to funnel you to them. Back before we had purchased our Aerohive deployment, I was talking to our Apple rep and said, hey, we're going to upgrade our wireless. And she said, who are you using? I said, Aerohive. She said, you'll be fine. You know, they really recommend Aerohive. And really for them, they need a vendor that they can trust that's going to make great gear. Because if Wi-Fi doesn't work well, then people a lot of times will blame the iPad.
Oh, absolutely. We actually have a very close partnership with Apple on the education side of the house. And so, you know, we've been supporting Apple events for their own customer, you know, seminars and things like that because, you know, they found that we are a good trusted partner and we extend and enhance the Apple solution in a very complementary fashion. I think that's the same with Jamf software is, you know, Apple is gaining, they've been a dominant, you know, vendor for the education market, and they're gaining much more of that adoption in the enterprise space as well. And so we see Apple as a great partner who we really want to extend and enhance their solutions because we see them as really pioneering, you know, where the industry is going. And we think just enabling their solutions really helps customers deploy technology that works.
Yeah, that's great. And again, we've tried our hardest not to make this an Aerohive show, but I absolutely love the product. It's since I've deployed it, it's been rock solid. We've just been thrilled. Frazier and I were texting today about, you know, how rock solid it's been and how really it's just a breath of fresh air that something would work as well as it's claimed to be. It's just great.
Yeah, and you know, I think one of the things that we try to focus on is not only the technology itself, but trying to deliver solutions that make sense from the business's perspective. So we try to go that one step further and work with our customers and get feedback and solve their challenges rather than just solving, you know, technology challenges, right? I can build a better hardware widget or software widget that, you know, that makes your connection optimized, right? And that's good. But what happens when it doesn't meet your workflow or your process in your organization? So in education specifically, you know, we've got a bundled into our access point is a feature called Teacher View, which enables teachers to have better visibility and manage technology in the classroom and control the classroom better than they could before so that they can maybe focus on the lesson plan rather than focusing on, well, if I bring 30 laptops in for students, how do I know if they're working or not? Because lots of times students don't raise their hand and say it's not working. Sometimes they just sit there and are afraid to do so. So the old way was, you know, teachers had to walk around the room, take time out of the lesson plan to make sure technology was working. And with Teacher View, we give teachers into the students and the devices in their classroom, and at a glance, they can see if everybody's working, what website they're on, making sure they're staying on lesson plan, and really control that classroom to keep the focus on the lesson plan and the content. And so those are some. That's just one of the ways in education specifically that, you know, we're trying to solve the teacher's needs, not necessarily the technology, you know, needs that we would focus on as a Silicon Valley, you know, vendor. Really understanding their problems and solving those.
I guess in closing, tell us a little bit about your blog. I follow it regularly, but for the listeners that haven't, tell us a little bit about the purpose of it and where they can find it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've been blogging for it must have been 2 or 3 years now since I started, and it's on a website called revolutionwifi.blogspot.com. And it's if you're a geek that's into wireless or I have some wired articles up there as well, but it's mainly Wi-Fi. You know, I just blog about relevant industry topics and challenges and solutions that I run across, and I'm amazed at how much readership I've gained in the time that I've been blogging. I never imagined that, you know, I would gather a following of the size that I have, but I kind of just jumped into it without even thinking about it because I was studying for my CCIE certification at the time. I said, well, this might be a good place to just put up my notes and the things that I run across in case it's useful to other people. And, you know, I've gotten a lot of great feedback from blogging. So social media has been great for me for the community aspect.
Yeah, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. And you're also Revolution Wi-Fi on Twitter as well.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter daily. You know, one of my big tenets is that, you know, share the knowledge rather than, you know, keep it to myself. So there's a great community of IT professionals in general, and networking professionals both on the wired and wireless side, specifically on Twitter. So it's a great place to run ideas by people, to get feedback and to get insight into things, you know, hey, you're trying to solve a problem. Rather than go research it for 5 hours and try to figure it out from scratch on your own, run it by the community on Twitter, and you know what? You can get a very helpful link and direction, so you don't waste 5 hours going researching something. You can get direct to the point, maybe within, you know, 30 minutes or an hour, so that you can just be more productive.
Yeah, I agree. I use that, you know, generally weekly or daily. I was working on an issue this morning, upgrading a VM of a macOS 10 server to 10.8. And I use a program called Apple Software Toolkit you netboot a machine onto an Apple Software Toolkit machine. It runs all these automated scans and sends it back to Apple. And so if it detects that the battery's bad and it's under warranty, Apple already knows that. And so it's kind of recording history of the machine. And I was getting that machine up to Mountain Lion server. Well, I did not see the netboot section. Well, there's a netboot section, but all it wants you to do is load an image of a netboot so you can, you know, push out images to a machine, but that's not what I needed. So I sent a message on Twitter and had two replies, got the answer within about 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The community is so engaged on Twitter. It's just fantastic. I mean, I liken it to, you know, I'm moving a lot of my conversations off of email, which used to be, you know, a very small community maybe within an organization. And it really allows you to expand your reach globally. I mean, I've met so many people on Twitter, and then it's really exciting when you have a common reason to actually meet them in person. It's just, it blows your mind of you know, you interacted with them for a year or two on Twitter, and then you go meet them in person, and, you know, it's just this whole level of interaction, and it scales your professional network to a global scale rather than a much more limited, you know, community that may be just in your organization.
I agree. Andrew, thanks for being on the show today. Again, we'll have links to his blog and his Twitter account in the show notes. Again, thanks to EasyGrade for sponsoring the show today. Again, it's an iPhone app that replaces your old cardboard EasyGrader. It's 99 cents in the App Store, EasyGradeApp.com. Go buy it now. Tell them that we sent you to support the show. Andrew, thanks for being on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Bradley.